Testing. Okay, everybody, we're going to get this party started over here. If you haven't made your way over, make your way over here. We've got Dean Hakamovich, General Manager, Windows Internet Explorer. You heard him in the keynote. Talk all about Internet Explorer 8. He's here for some Q&A. And let me just tell you how we'll make this work. We are recording this, so it's very important that we hear your question. So if you have a question for Dean, if you'd please raise your hand, wait for me to get the microphone to you. Speak loudly into the microphone, hold it close to your mouth, kind of like that. And if we can't hear you, I'll repeat it, so don't worry about that. And then we'll let the man of the hour answer the question. So with that, Dean, is there any opening thing you want to comment on, or should we just take our first question?
Take the first question.
All right. Any, raise your hand if you've got a question about Internet Explorer, Internet Explorer 8. We've got the man here.
We can have a call out to Adrian on the Internet Explorer team. An area expert, if ever one there was, on the platform.
You have a question?
Yes.
All right.
So, first, congratulations on shipping IE8. So,
thank you.
Yes, and the question I have is, as you start to look to IE9, what are you thinking about as the big areas you want to tackle on IE9?
Wow. Okay. So, what are we going to do with IE9? You know, this is. You know, it's great to start with a "What have you done for me lately?" question on the day that we ship. You know, we're thinking really hard about a lot of things for developers, and I think that's the most pressing conversation to have here. I think about everything that we heard that went into IE8, and there was a lot of stuff that went, "Oh, it'd be so great to do that," and we didn't get to it. So it's always tempting to do that, and then it's always tempting to look ahead and say, what is it that developers never dreamed that they could do? I'm not sure if you've had a reaction yet. I was just asking Lori this. If you've tried writing a web slice or accelerator yet?
I've not done an accelerator.
See, it's interesting. When we started IE8, there was all this conversation around, how can we get script plus markup and an extensibility thing? And we said, why not make it easier than that? And so in some ways, as we look ahead, I always think about the articulated needs and then the unarticulated needs. So there are a bunch of obvious articulated needs. Hey, what about your script engine? Hey, what about this standard, that standard? And then there's the whole, I never thought of asking for that. Just for the sake of heritage, since we have so many people here, I just want to go back to the 90s. I spent the 90s working on what turned out to be Office. And no one ever wrote it and said, I really want you to take the words that I know how to spell, but my fingers happen to, slip up, and just fix those without asking them. If there is never an articulation for autocorrect, there is a clear unarticulated need. And I think that we're in a target-rich environment for developers to make that a lot better. This is how we're thinking about it.
All right, other questions? If not, I've got one. Because I saw the keynote this morning, of course. And one of the questions I had, we didn't have time to really talk about the developer toolbar.
Yes.
Right? And we got a lot of developers here, we certainly have a lot of designers here. And I'd love, for those who haven't heard about it, to hear about the developer toolbar.
Okay, so the first thing I'm going to say about the developer toolbar is John Hrovatin. So is John Hrovatin in the room? Because if he is, he was the spiritual force behind it. In terms of what does the dev toolbar do, and why should you guys be excited about it? I think the most exciting thing with the developer toolbar is that it gives you a view of how IE8 is looking at all the code and markup in memory. So it's not about what you typed in to your web app, it's how IE actually parsed it. Somebody made a point to me this morning about when you start having script manipulating CSS, and you really get lost in what's actually happening. The dev toolbar is your friend and your savior at that point. A few highlights of the dev toolbar, just in terms of, again, the feedback that I've heard. The ability to do style tracing. So you're sitting there going, why is this blue? And being able to selectively, with, frankly, a trial and error approach, figure out why your page is the way it is absolutely huge. And personally, I found the profiling unbelievably helpful. Because I'll sit there and go, why is this behaving? Why is the performance the way it is? That's my personal highlights film. On the dev toolbar. I'm going to call out to a member of the IE team who's here. Do you have a dev toolbar highlight that I haven't mentioned? You've been on both sides of the IE team, both in Redmond and outside.
So I think for me, I think it's a really want to highlight is the fact that the dev toolbar is in the box. Right? It's on the machine, the code's installed there, the i8's there, the toolbar's there. So, you know, we've all been there, you go to somebody's desk, they're the one having the problem, and now you've been wanting to store things, probably not. So yeah, practice, it's just there. So that's the main thing.
Excellent point.
I'm Dan, the next time I use it. F12, right? It's installed. I have an MSDN blog, and over just for background, there's no way to really edit the layout of the MSDN blogs other than overriding a bunch of CSS. And every time I do it, it's absolutely, it's really a big pain, to be honest with you. But I, many times now, that I've been on an IE8 F12, figure out what style is overriding what, and why it doesn't look the way I want. It's fantastic. So they have a good thing. So, questions. Anybody has a question, raise your hand, and I will bring the microphone. Yes.
Can you use the toolbar for debugging the older versions of IE, like if you have set to rendering IE7 or other modes?
Yeah, so the dev toolbar is available in IE8 no matter what mode you set it to. So whether it's quirks, IE7 compat, standards, IE8 mode, it's all there, which is great. You know, maybe it's one of the things as we pass the microphone over. One of the other great things about the dev toolbar is you're sitting there working through what Oculus call one of these cross-browser issues, and you're trying to experiment to figure it out. That interactive nature, being able to just flip between the different tabs and, you know, again, take trial and error, whether it's with script or styling, is absolutely crucial. Sorry, go ahead.
So how does it work with slices, the dev toolbar?
Maybe a good place to start is just, you know, how do you approach making a slice, and then how does the dev toolbar help you? To me, the easiest way to describe a slice is start from a web page that you already have, right? Any web page that you already have, and basically you add a little bit of markup and a div with a name, and you know the little toolbar button lights up and turns green, and you have a slice. I'll admit that the first slice I wrote was in Notepad. I literally took one of the samples from someone else on the IE team, and I, image source equals, I took the traffic map that I actually demoed today, and I just copied the div out. The dev toolbar helps when you're on the page with a web slice in terms of being able to experiment with, well, did I really want alt text? There's a great trick, just a really great trick about web slices that not many people pick up on, which is that the web slice that shows up when the user clicks in the favorites bar doesn't have to be what they saw on the web page when they got it. And so you can have a really great web page where you get people to add the slice, and then when people click on the slice, there can be a different slice. And there's this whole alt mechanism. And there's a blog post on blogs.msdn.com/IE. There's a blog post from somebody on the team that describes exactly, it really is like your first web slice in under 5 minutes. And the dev toolbar is great because as you have that page, you can experiment with it and do that whole interactive thing.
Yeah. Other questions? Hands. Well, so I'll ask another one.
It's great to have a show.
So, when we were talking about keynote demos. You know, one of the demos that we originally were going to include and weren't able to include was a cross-site scripting demo that I actually thought was pretty illustrative, which basically showed how scary the situation is and explained what cross-site scripting was. And I don't know that everyone understands, even at a high level, what goes on there and what we've done in IE8 to actually help that situation.
Okay, so just first, show of hands. Cross-site scripting, heard of it? Cross-site scripting, you know, could explain it to a security expert if your life depended on it. Okay, so let's start with this cross-site scripting thing. You guys have written a site. You have an amazing website. You've made it, you know, have great performance. It works cross-browser. It's just great. There's just one problem. The bad guys can inject a script into it. If you have a great website and you don't, to be very technical, sanitize your inputs. If it's too easy for a bad guy to just insert a little bit of script, maybe through a URL, then really bad things can happen. And the demo basically runs like this. There's a Hotmail message, and it looks like it's really from your bank. and you click on the link, and you look up in the address bar, and that top-level domain bolding still holds true. And you look up the URL, and it really is the right URL. Right? And at this point, you're really at the site. Now, here's what happens with the cross-site script. The bad guys injected just a little bit of extra script so that when the user clicks on a link, instead of just running what's on your site, they run a little bit of extra script as well. Think about this a lot like SQL injection, or think about this a lot like essentially you're just passing in some extra parameters where you just didn't expect parameters to be. Is that fair without a whiteboard behind me? Now, the bad news is that in the browser that doesn't have cross-site scripting protection, you click on that link and you start typing in, for example, your username and password, and that script that was injected reflects all that typing back to the bad guys, which is a bummer. And so it's your site, and it's a great site, and people who come to your site end up losing all of their keystrokes to the bad guys. IE8 has got a bunch of heuristics that detect cross-site scripting, and what we do essentially is we neuter the script. All right, so now that I've done the geek out thing, what's the difference? So other folks will tell you, hey, run the NoScript add-on. Step one, install the NoScript add-on. Step two, run the NoScript add-on and, you know, start disabling script for this site or that site. And there's a problem. You disable script for a site, the script doesn't work. I don't know how to run Gmail without script. And, you know, if you're going to manually pick and choose which sites you're running the script, you're not really all that safe. The cross-site scripting filter for all sites goes through and looks for the pattern of cross-site scripting and automatically neuters it, so that all the scripts run except for the bad one that was injected. Is that mostly what you saw?
Totally what I saw. It was. So I technically kind of understood what it was when I saw the demo, but I'd never seen it in action. And to actually see just a very long URL with a query string and mysterious characters, and then your actual bank login, that's the thing that freaked me out. This wasn't like a well-designed, looked-like-your-bank-login. This was the bank login.
And literally, when you look at the address bar, it's your bank. And if you pretty print the URL, it's angle bracket script, and you're going, oh my god, it's my bank, only there's an extra script running as part of the URL.
And if we could show the demo, it literally was as you type your username and password, some remote user, whatever they want to be, you could receive all that information. And as somebody who is fairly technical, and somebody who actually looks at the URL, that's like my measure of, yep, that's good, freaked me out because I wouldn't have caught that. I saw a hand over here with questions.
You know, a pretty common thing I ran into last year was that a lot of your requests had text estimates and that, and then eval coded your script tags inside text and SQL servers.
Yes.
So, on premise, you have a link to a SQL server, which might be like something that has an eval to your tags. Is that so bad?
It stops. Okay, that's a question. Does it? You're asking whether it stops linked JSs?
So, you know, it's not my routine that's injected or already in the SQL server or whatever database I have. So now it's inside my text, which I text to text render, but it doesn't do an HTML and it doesn't
do
so now I have it linked inside my site, and it gets printed in IE, but this cross-site scripting stops it for me. Is there a heuristic in SQLs?
You're going to hear three words that you rarely hear from a Microsoft employee. I don't know. Next grade sequence of words, I'll find out. Do you have to know, Adrian, or should we? If you don't know, we can, you know, find Aaron.
So Eric will be around to talk on a bit of detail of that.
Right. There's a feeling that Eric Lawrence, who's our security guy, he just gave a talk, I think, yeah. And we will find him.
All right. But it does, in order for that link to get onto the page, some script has to run to start with them.
The URL has the text
decimal
that gets
email.
Can you
put the mic on? Now,
no, it just hasn't worked.
It's not the script, it's really the URL. Once the URL gets parsed, the email is on the server. So it's not really JavaScript that's the problem, it's just once they get that code inside SQL Server.
Well, script is never the problem.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
So you're talking about. Actually, this is code to get run on the server as a consequence of the URL request.
Yeah.
So the URL is has Someone wasn't scoring the parameters right, text doesn't go, and the eval statement gets sent to SQL Server. SQL Server evals that hexadecimal and runs the query. So that's how they're hiding their SQL query. And then it's parsing SQL Server looking for text fields, and it's shown to this script tag. And the script tag now is executing every time they make this request to the username. And if you look inside SQL Server, you see script link inside all the fields. So you can scrub it out, but you know, I have to look for it once I get off of the client. Just hoping that maybe IE had some intelligence.
We're going to find out.
Get it out for me.
We're going to find out.
So, most likely, it won't protect for all of those things. If it hits one of the heuristics, then that's really designed for directly JavaScript protection, then really what you're talking about is a SQL injection attack. And you still need to protect against the injection separately.
But the general pattern, right, is that there are more attacks that are going to go on against your sites than ever before. Clip jacking, cross-site scripting, it's very simple. The bad guys go for whatever's soft. You know, why attack a well-fortified door if there is a nice glass window to break? And as you write your sites, you just need to get used to the fact that folks will attack you. And it's nice to have some browser site protections to essentially have defense in depth. But there's a whole art and skill to understanding how bad guys will look at your sites. Sure.
Other questions? Hands? Excellent.
Hi, I'm going to point into this. Basically, we have a problem with PeopleSoft that lets us upgrade from IE6. And so we're having to look at doing FB or something else in order to have different versions of IE running.
Okay, so the question I think we'll pick it up was the, hey, we're stuck using IE6 because we have this interesting piece of software that we have to use that insists that we run IE6. So how do we deal? Step one, frankly, is Ray. Ray, who's standing here, has friends all over the industry. So Ray's, I'm not trying to be negative here, right? I'm being candid. So whether it's Siebel or SAP or PeopleSoft, there's a lot of work going on actively. There's been a lot of work over the last 6 months going forward as well with folks like PeopleSoft on compatibility. That's step one. Step two is, well, what do you do to have 6 and other browsers in the same environment? And then there's a list of decent workarounds, whether it's virtual PC on the client, whether it's term serve. We've got scenarios. The thing that I've seen a lot in companies is somebody just sets up a terminal server, or there's a set of terminal server accounts, and folks term serve in, a nice way to deal with a compat issue. The most important thing is that we make sure that the thing runs with 8, and we have a set of folks working on that. Brad, I'm not sure if you can talk about this.
So to answer your specific question about virtualization, that is something that we're looking at. Now that IE8 is out the door and shipped, I expect that perhaps we'll have something to say about that relatively soon. So we are looking at it. I'm certain that we'll get there. It's just a matter of figuring out how and when, and that's when the next thing's on the docket. To echo off some of the things that Dean said, if you want to give me a card, I'm happy to ping you and engage. We'll look at your very specific application, what's going on there, and what we might be able to help sort of get that working.
Plus, there's a lab going on. If you haven't found me, over in the corner, with a lot of folks who can answer these two questions too. Other hands? Or will it not?
Yeah, users.
Can you talk more into the mic?
Sometimes we look at Windows Live account. They have the ability to hold on to favorites, history, your browser settings. Is that somewhere in the roadmap?
That's a great question. Just to repeat for the early part, I have a lot of interesting information on my machine, like my identities and my history and my logins, and I want them to come with me as I go from machine to machine. That's an unbelievably important scenario. The way that it works is when you have a cloud to go and put things up and back and forth from. I'll give you a Microsoft solution and a non-Microsoft solution. If you grab the latest Windows Live, they've got this thing called SkyDrive. I think it used to be Folder Share. And what you can do is when you install that, you can point at your favorites folder and some of the, a bunch of your other information, and it will reflect it up to the cloud. And everywhere you install that, it'll show up. So your favorites, and I think you should be able to point at some of your other information as well. There's a non-Microsoft solution that used to be called Foxmarks after another browser, and they dropped the FO. And now they're called Xmarks, and they work in IE very nicely. So either of those solutions should be right. Other questions?
Steve Wilmer is talking about using a book into using WebSphere. What are your thoughts on
that? Steve, I think, was in Australia, or was asked a question by a student with an Australian accent. And it involved using WebKit. And Steve gave this very long answer. I got about 15 pieces of email after this answer hit the press. And so I went and I watched the video, Joy of the Internet. Now, the question before, I think, had to do with Xbox, and the question after had to do with EU. So I think it's a good example of how much stuff Steve has to answer. Steve's answer about WebKit was basically open-minded, because Steve has a lot of things that he has in his mind. The very short answer is no. If you look especially at what we just released in i8, go look at the CSS testing. Go look at the 7,200 tests that we've contributed with community help, and go look at the several hundred tests that already exist there. Right now, the i8 engine passes more of the CSS tests than anyone else. It's interesting to see all the different engines out there. There was a great Ars Technica interview after one of the WebKit browsers shipped, I can't remember which, with one of the Mozilla guys. And they said, hey, Mozilla guys, why don't you switch to WebKit? And the Mozilla guys had a very good answer on why they were investing what they're investing in, and we see a great, great future in the engine that we're working on, and we're still going with it. The Steve thing's interesting. Go dig up the original video. It's a lot of fun to watch. Steve plays off the word cheeky as well. It's very funny. I like Steve Ballmer videos.
I've got another one teed up. Unless we've got another question here. So, this morning, again, one of the things that I was disappointed we didn't have time to include, right? We talked about all this data that we get. Like, we're at the end of this fire hose of data that comes back from all these browsers. Of course, we've got so many browsers installed out there, we get a lot of data that actually was very insightful to me, right? It's just a mountain of data, there's a lot of gold in it. So from an end-user perspective, what are the top things that people do that might surprise us or be interesting to us? Just off the top.
Paul Kutzinger, I think, was his talk already? It's now. There's talk going on now with the PM lead, who actually sifted through a lot of this data, is talking about how we were data-driven. It's a great talk. I'm sure it'll be on video. I think that my biggest surprise is looking at the data. I'll choose one since I made fun of them for it. Delete browsing history is nowhere near as common a command as I thought it would be. I really expected its incidence would be a lot higher. It's not just that everyone in college guessed, oh, delete browsing history, that's all I do. It really just wasn't used all that much. And I think the humbling part is when you look across tens of millions of sessions, you realize that these commands that you consider crucial are used by a very, very, very small percentage of people. And it is ordering pizza for 100 million people, where you just have these broad swaths. Like there are IT pros who go through and say, how can you imagine not having slipstream deployment? And you have security professionals saying, how can you imagine not having this? And you just go slice by slice. And it's just so broad.
Other questions? I think we're about a half hour. Is there anything else you want to add before we close?
I just want to encourage anyone who watches the video or anyone who's eavesdropping at this point to not just download, but go write a slice. Go write an accelerator. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by just how easy it is. and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by just how much benefit people get when they have immediate access to the website you've already written, wherever they go in the browser. I think that's been the big eye-opening experience. There have been folks coming up to me during the show. I met some of the folks from Ascena. I think I downloaded some of their music stuff. Giorgio just about fell over himself saying, I really thought it would be hard. There's a great story. There's a story I heard. I want to corroborate it, but I'll share it briefly. The fellow who did Shareaholics, the accelerator that I show, my understanding is that he wrote it in a couple of hours. And to me, the ability to take something you already have and, frankly, rather quickly turn it into something that tens of millions of people can plug in to their browser in under 30 seconds is just amazing. And so that's going to be my, it will surprise you. Try that out. And thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Dean.